Okay, we're going to call the Senate Resources Committee to order. Today, it's April the 8th, and it's, let the record reflect, it's snowing outside. And we do have a quorum to conduct business consisting of Senator Wagner, Senator French, Co-Chairman Wilikowski, and myself, McGuire. We have five things today on the agenda. The very first thing we're going to do is hear a presentation from ConocoPhillips, hear from them. We have Dan Clark here, who's the manager of Cook Inlet Assets. Very excited. We have House Bill 210, Eisenbeck State Game Refuge Land Exchange. We have HJR 40, which is a resolution, joint resolution dealing with Cook Inlet and Kachemak Bay beluga population. HJR 26 regarding statehood and ANCSA land survey funding. And HCR 10 opposing federal control of state land and water. That will be the order here today. And so without further ado, we'll ask Mr. Clark, Dan Clark, to come forward from ConocoPhillips and talk to us. Welcome to the Senate Resources Committee. Welcome to Juneau in the spring.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Madam Co-Chair McGuire, Mr. Co-Chair Wilikowski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Clark. I'm the manager of the Cook Inlet Assets for ConocoPhillips, Alaska. ConocoPhillips operates three assets in the Cook Inlet area. On the west side of the Cook Inlet, we operate the Beluga River unit. Offshore, we operate the North Cook Inlet unit, and we also operate the Kenai LNG plant near Nikiski. Between the Beluga River unit and the North Cook Inlet unit, ConocoPhillips operates approximately 160 to 170 million cubic feet a day of natural gas production currently. I have three main discussion points to share with you this afternoon. First, I'll give you a brief background of the Kenai LNG plant. I'll discuss the near-term future of the Kenai LNG plant, and I will also third discuss the benefits of the continued operation of the Kenai facility. First, on background, the Kenai LNG plant has been operating for over 40 years and is currently the only significant industrial user of natural gas in South Central Alaska. The Kenai LNG plant received a two-year extension to its export license in 2008, effective April 1st, 2009, and that license will expire March 31st of 2011. This extension provided for the approval to export up to 99 trillion BTUs, which is approximately 99 billion cubic feet of natural gas. During the first year of that export extension, we have exported 27.9 trillion BTUs to date, so just less than a third of the authorized volume. The plant's owned by the Kenai LNG Corporation, with ConocoPhillips owning 70% of the shares and Marathon owning the remaining 30% of the shares. Second, to talk about the near-term future of the plant, ConocoPhillips has informed the U.S. Department of Energy and the Governor of Alaska of our intent to seek an extension to the export license up to March 31st, 2013. The extension request will be for existing volumes of natural gas. No increase in volume for export will be requested from the 99 trillion BTUs that was previously authorized by the Department of Energy. This export extension is only a request to extend the time available to export the original volume. Next, I'd like to talk about the benefits of continued operation of the facility. The Kenai LNG facility contributes significantly to the state and local economies. The LNG facility provides about $130 million per year in economic benefits to the state and local economies. For ConocoPhillips operations, the LNG facility supports about 60 direct jobs and is estimated to support an additional 50 indirect jobs. The direct and indirect jobs account for an estimated $17 million a year in personal income.
I'm going to stop you just a second.
Sure.
Dan, thank you so much. It's a very exciting announcement. We've been waiting to find out this from ConocoPhillips, and many of us have written letters and government officials just trying to really bolster the support that you might have with the Department of Energy for this export license that's so rare, the only one in the United States. And so we're grateful to look forward to continue to work with you as Alaskans in this endeavor in the LNG plant. I just want to note for the record that we're happily joined by our energy co-chairman on the other side, Representative Bryce Edgman and Representative Charisse Millett. We're also joined by Representative Jay Ramris here today in the room, and then Senator Wagner had a question for you.
Sure. Well, I just had a correction. I, I think you misspoke. You said 99 trillion cubic feet, and I think you meant billion.
Okay, I'm sorry. The correct authorized amount, if I misspoke, is 99 trillion BTUs, which is equivalent to 99 billion cubic feet.
Okay.
So about 1 trillion BTUs equals 1 billion cubic feet.
I want to make sure the folks at home didn't get really excited to find someplace.
No. Trillion BTUs.
Excellent. Yeah. And no increase, just an extension. And you asked for a 2-year extension?
That's what our intent is, to pursue a 2-year extension.
Okay, so March 31st, 2013, and you know we our in-state gas caucus, we outreached with Congressman Young, and he got so excited about the endeavor that he wrote a letter to Secretary Chu asking for a decade-long expansion. And, you know, that's the kind of guy he is, and we appreciate that, and we'll see what the Department of Energy has to say. But he thought that 10 years might be a longer time period in which ConocoPhillips and Marathon could, you know, make business decisions. So thank you.
Just to move on, the production of gas for feedstock to the LNG facility and the sale of LNG generate about $60 million a year in royalties and taxes for the state of Alaska and the Kenai Peninsula borough. Furthermore, continued operation of the LNG plant helps to bridge the gap to the time when local storage options can be expanded or until other sources of natural gas, including North Slope natural gas, becomes available to South Central Alaska. Additionally, it is important to note that the LNG plant has provided and can continue to provide an invaluable service to the South Central gas market. The plant owners have diverted natural gas to local utility markets when unexpected supply interruptions occur or when peak winter demands are excessive. Finally, and very importantly for South Central Alaska's energy security, the continued operation of the plant allows for a stable production environment, which will significantly reduce the risk of water influx and associated loss of reserves and deliverability associated with the shut-in of production. During the summer months and the shoulder winter seasons, the utility market cannot absorb the natural gas production the Cook Inlet Basin is capable of producing. However, during the winter, and specifically during winter cold spells, when demand increases up to threefold, the deliverability of the basin is matched or even outstripped by utility demand. Shutting in producing gas wells can damage the reservoirs and cause the loss of reserves and deliverability, resulting in reduced supply for residential needs. To summarize, in addition to jobs and a healthier economy, continued operation of the plant means natural gas will be available for local utility providers, heat and electric, and in the event of supply interruptions or excessive peak demand, in discontinued use of the LNG facility would actually mean less natural gas would be available to meet utility and residential needs. Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, I would like to thank you and the other committee members gathered here today for this opportunity to speak with you. Through the chair, I'm now available to address any questions that you may have.
Thank you so much, Mr. Clark. Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Clark, for being here with this news. Many of the constituents that we represent, particularly in the Anchorage area, look at the export of natural gas overseas and say, why is our gas that we pay so much for going to a foreign country? So maybe you could tell us why that is and why that's a good thing, or explain to them why it's a good thing. And then, and also, while you answer that, tell me, if you can, how much that gas sells for overseas.
Sure. Senator French, through the chair. I think at the current point in time, I would describe at this time stage that we're in, the primary reason that it's a good idea to continue exports is it allows, because of the significant swing in demand from summer to winter, very low volumes in the summer to very high volumes in the winter, if there was no market like this export market, wells would shut in. Wells would have to physically be shut in. It would lead to a risk of water influx and other failures in the well. And so even though gas is physically leaving the state, it allows that production to continue and maintain at a high deliverability. So when it's needed, it can simply be diverted. So that's, I believe that's the answer currently. I think in previous years, there was so much excess deliverability in gas, it generated jobs and taxes and revenue and all those things. Current sales prices are quite strong in Japan. Pricing in Japan, and this is public data, so I can share it easily, is around $11 in MMBTU. And just to maybe give you a reference point, NSTAR's average cost of gas is around $7 in MMBTU this year. So it's quite a strong price in Japan right now.
So just to follow up on that, because this has been a persistent, I guess I could just call it a rumor given the numbers you've just given us, but the persistent rumor is that the gas that you're selling or is being sold overseas is being sold for less than what is being charged here in the Anchorage or in the Anchorage area. And so could you just sort of reassure folks that that's not the case?
Yeah, Senator French, through the chair, I know that question has existed in the past for some time. While I don't have perfect knowledge of the data, I think there's maybe been a handful of months in the history of exporting that's maybe been true. So for over 40 years, with the exception of a handful of months, the price has always been higher in Japan.
Thank you.
Excellent question. This is Senator Wagner.
When our gas gets, this is just for my own edification, when your gas gets over and gets regasified in Japan, do they then blend it in so it's got a higher BTU value? And how much is that increased over there? Because they're set up a little different on their equipment, aren't they?
Yeah. Senator Wagner, through the chair. The gas that is the LNG that's exported from Kenai is considered a lean LNG. It's about 1,000 BTUs per standard cubic foot. LNG can range up to 1,200 or 2,200 BTUs per standard cubic foot. Actually, our LNG that's exported from the Kenai plant has to go to a specific set of tanks that can deal with our lean LNG. So they isolate it, and then once it's regasified, then it's blended into their system for use.
Okay, that's what I want. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
What is the process that we should look forward to as Alaskans? You've submitted the request for the extension, and then is there a public comment period? And if Alaskans, lawmakers, chambers of commerce, people want to weigh in to support that extension, what's the process we go through and the timeline?
Our current thinking is still evolving exactly what our process is going to be going forward. Our timeline and thinking, Madam Co-Chair, is to submit the application sort of by the end of May to the Department of Energy, and then they will enter a process, and I can't speak to exactly what it'll be, but there will be a comment period. I don't know what that is right now.
Okay. Well, we look forward to having you keep us posted. And then the other question I had, and then Senator Wilkowski, is with respect to the possibility of an in-state line, and you may not be able to elaborate on that, but if there are conversations or plans that you've considered about how the LNG plant might fit into those business plans as a industrial base?
Madam Co-Chair, obviously the plant's there. It's been operating for 40 years. One thing I would say is for a long-term continued use of the plant, 20, 30, 40 years, which I think would be the kind of timeline we'd be talking about with a major delivery of gas from the North Slope, there would need to be some renewal in the plant. And primarily, we have a significant amount of compression in the plant, and that would need to be renewed. So it would require some investment. It would be less than having to build a new plant, but it would require a good bit of work to do that. So I think, it's there, it's available, and then obviously commercial terms would have to happen between the parties, the sellers of gas and the plant, the owners of the plant.
Excellent. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for the presentation, Mr. Clark. Do you believe there is sufficient gas in Cook Inlet to sustain the extension of this extension agreement?
Senator Wilkowski, I do. I think when you look at where volumes are today compared to where demand is, it's evident to us that there will be additional deliverability beyond what local needs are for the next couple of years beyond the current export license. And so, given that, our look at that and the intent would be to only export volumes beyond what is needed for the local needs.
Got a few questions, Madam Chair, if I could. We've been hearing that there's potential crisis in Cook Inlet. We're on the verge of brownouts. Do you share that assessment?
Senator Wilkowski, obviously supply volumes have been declining. I mean, it's indisputable. pretty significantly. I will say in the last year that's moderated. When you look at volumes from peak winter time last year to, granted it was a mild winter, but when you look at the peak delivery days, it was fairly flat, only maybe 3 or 4% less this year than it was last. Could there be problems during the coldest days? Yes, I think there is a risk of that, and that you know, essentially all the systems will have to run well to be able to meet those demands. But I think the key here, when we look at this particular time period, is those are just a few days out of the year, and in order to be ready for those days, to have a continue stable flow of production is what's important.
One of the concerns that I've heard is that some of the compression pumps could fail. Is that your understanding of one of the concerns on the colder days?
Yeah, I do, Senator Wilkowski, yes. I think that there are several key compressors in the system overall when you look at it. So if there was a major failure, that would be a significant concern.
Sure. And if I could, are those ConocoPhillips compressor pumps? And if so, do you have plans to upgrade those pumps or to add additional pumps so that we don't have a failure in our system?
The one that, excuse me, Senator Wilkowski, the compressor that is discussed is there's a central compressor at the Beluga River unit where all the volumes from the 15 or so producing wells in the Beluga River unit flow through and deliver either to Chugach or into NSTAR system. They all flow through that compressor. If that compressor were to fail, that's certainly one of those incidents that people could be could potentially be concerned about. What I will say is we already have a set of additional compressors that are backup, that when that compressor fails, we turn on these other compressors. Now, what happens is there tends to be a few minutes delay between those two events, and so that can create a loss of pressure in the system, and there can be a temporary issue, but we already do have backup compressors. Now, with respect to the rest of the system, I guess I'm not intimately familiar with where other producers, what their situations are.
Okay. And we've all seen the graphs, sort of we call them the waterfall chart, which shows the big drop-off in Cook Inlet gas in upcoming years. And do you believe there's enough reserves in Cook Inlet to last Cook Inlet for years to come?
Senator Wilkowski, I've seen all those same charts, and those are typically looking at deliverability. Reserves is really a different question. That's the volume of gas in the ground. There's certainly adequate reserves for the next several years. I think the question and concerns that continue to come up are around deliverability on those peak, those coldest days, a minus 20 degree day. That's when the concern is, and that's when you need the system to run smoothly, when deliveries out of storage have to occur, those types of things. So I think there's adequate reserves. It's the deliverability that tends to be the concern.
In the last extension, you agreed to drill new wells. And what was the result of that additional drilling that you did? And do you intend to drill more wells if this extension is granted?
Yes, Senator Wilkowski. At the last extension, the agreement that we came to with the state was that we would propose two wells at the Beluga River unit. There's two other owners in that unit, MLNP and Chevron. So we proposed those two wells in 2008. Those wells were drilled. That was the extent of our commitment, just to propose those wells. Those wells were approved and drilled in 2008. We drilled another well at the Beluga River unit in 2009. And we, in addition to that, we drilled three wells at the North Cook Inlet unit. All of those wells are, with the exception of one, are currently on production and producing. I guess just to sort of generalize, I mean, the results weren't gangbusters, but we are, you know, seeing good delivery and volumes out of those wells.
A few more questions. Do you see the need to drill additional wells, and do you anticipate drilling additional wells under this extension?
Senator Wilkowski, specific to this particular path that we're on to pursue an export extension, and that we're not seeking to add volumes to export, we don't see a need to tie additional drilling to that. However, I will say that the contracts that are signed to ultimately sell gas, that's what in our view tends to work best to drive activity. In other words, when a deal is signed with a particular utility or a deal signed with a buyer in Japan, the particular terms of that contract is what works best to drive drilling activity.
And do you believe that if we if you get the extension agreement, or if we agree not to support your extension agreement, that this will provide all the storage that's needed for Cook Inlet, or will we still need additional gas storage?
Senator Wilkowski, good question. We think storage is needed, additional storage beyond where we are today. What the LNG plant does is provides a sort of a virtual storage because of the ability to divert gas away from the plant. For the long-term benefit of Cook Inlet, additional underground storage is needed. That's our view to help. When that is in place, that will be another tool that will allow steady production, because storage would be in place to allow gas to flow into during the summer when there's no market, and then be able to be pulled when there is a high demand.
If I could, do you know what the cost is per MCF for you to extract the gas and deliver it?
I think we would consider that, Senator Wilkes, we would consider that proprietary information.
Do you, if I could, Madam Chair, do you believe that new incentives are needed to spur more gas storage facilities in Cook Inlet?
Senator Wilkowski, I think to spur new storage, I think it could be helpful. I don't know that that's that we have a particular view that there's any particular incentive that will make it happen. I think the need is very obvious that it's going to have to happen, but I don't know if there's any particular incentive that will make it happen.
And do you believe that new incentives are needed to spur more exploration in Cook Inlet?
Senator Wilkowski, obviously any incentives that could help improve economics of wells, would be helpful. I think as I testified to the same committee back in June, our view of the biggest challenge here is really the size of the market and the cyclical nature of it. And so that's really where we tend to see the issue is.
And then I think I'm almost done, Madam Chair. I appreciate the indulgence. You mentioned, I think, that you had paid, was it $60 million a year in royalty and taxes? Is
that's correct.
Okay. Do you know that's the state royalty of 12.5% and the taxes of 17.6 cents per MCF?
Right.
Do you know how much in recent years that had your overall taxes were diluted? You know, we've been talking a lot about the dilution effect of gas. Do you have any idea what the dilution effect of gas has been to ConocoPhillips in recent years?
Senator Wilkowski, I'm sorry, I don't know that answer. I'd have to go look into that.
Okay. I think that's all I have, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Two questions that you might have, I think you answered at the beginning. How many jobs does the plant right now currently, how many people do you employ at the plant?
Madam Co-Chair McGuire, at the plant itself, there's approximately 30 employees, ConocoPhillips employees.
Okay, and then on your contracts or contract with Japan, where are you in that, the life cycle of that contract?
Madam Co-Chair, the contract that we're currently in matched up with the two-year extension that we're in. And so we're making deliveries under that contract. To move beyond the March 31st, 2011 will require either this contract be amended or a new contract, which is yet to be in place. So that's a major piece of work that's ahead of us to make this happen.
Excellent. Okay, further questions?
Yeah.
Senator Wilkowski?
Are you I know there was some concern last time by the RCA that the state had agreed to sign on to support the extension request, and then the RCA was pretty critical of that, saying that that had hurt the utility's ability to negotiate a contract, basically took away the leverage for the utilities. Do you have contracts with all the utilities to provide gas? Do all our utilities have contracts to have gas right now? And what's your intent to provide gas to those utilities, I guess, before meeting the need for the export license?
Senator Wilikowski, their Chugach just submitted a contract last week to the RCA, so just beginning the process with them that I will meet their needs well through this period. So assuming that contract gets approved, then Chugach's need would be met during this time frame. NSTAR has not yet submitted a contract that meets their needs for that time frame, but my understanding is, and this is from I listened to Ms. Starian make a presentation a couple of days ago, that they will be submitting a contract to the RCA this week. Will it? I don't know that it'll cover all of their needs, but it's progressing that way.
Yeah. I'll just say, Madam Chair, I mean, as long as we can meet in-state needs and get affordable gas to the consumers of Cook Inlet, I'm in full support of this. But I just, you know, obviously want to make sure that we're meeting the needs of our consumers first before we agree to the export license.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a very exciting announcement. We appreciate you picking the committee today, Mr. Clark, to make the announcement. And again, we look forward to, you know, helping in that explanation to the public that I think has been challenging. And you know, in this committee a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about the very real possibility of having to import LNG and use the plant as a regasification plant, and that was a very troubling thought process for most of us, for me for sure. And so this is exciting news, and we're hopeful that you're successful in it, and again want to be supportive in your effort, and just appreciate you being here today.
Thank you, Senator McGuire.
Thank you. And we do have Carrie Lockhart from Marathon Oil online. Carrie, did you want to say anything?
Thank you, Senator McGuire. No, I think Dan covered the issues adequately, so I have no further comment.
Okay, thank you. Questions for Carrie? Okay, well, thank you very much. All right, so now we are going to turn to House Bill number 210, Eisenbeck Gate State Game Refuge Land Exchange. Welcome, Representative Edgman. Okay, and we do have a committee substitute before us, backslash E, for House Bill 210, and I would take a motion to put it before us properly.
We don't have a quorum, Madam Chair.
Oh, and we did just lose our quorum, so we'll wait on that. We'll go ahead and have you start your testimony, and then as soon as we get our quorum reconfigured, we will adopt the CS. So tell us about it.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Bryce Edgman, representative for House District 37. With me is my staff aide, Tim Clark, who will be describing the one amendment to the bill when we get to that point. But House Bill 210 deals with a much publicized, many-year struggle to establish a road between the community of King Cove and Cold Bay. And what the bill does, simply put, is it authorizes the Department of Natural Resource to make the transaction, given that the actual land exchange itself, which I'll talk about in more detail here in a moment, between land exchange between the federal government and the state is of unequal value. So Title 38 requires the Department of Natural Resources to be authorized to make a land transaction in that nature. Also, there's some submerged and some tide lands involved as part of the overall transaction, so the department needs to come in and be able to consummate that. But the road itself, again, is about 30 some odd miles between the community of King Cove and Cold Bay. And with the passage of House Bill 210, further work would still need to be done at the federal level to actually complete the full authorization for the construction of the small part of the road that's missing. And it's the Department of Interior would need to do environmental impact studying and also finding of public interest. And of course, course, that all sort of assumes that this bill would go through the process and get signed by the governor. But if I could just for a second zero in on this 27-mile road, and the whole crux of the issue is that if you turn over to the map over there, you can see that the dotted line actually between the two communities scales the side of a mountain, turns a corner, and then actually traverses through some very rich habitat that's considered world-class resting and feeding habitat for a number of birds that migrate through there annually. And so we're talking a pretty small sliver overall of going through the wilderness area, about the 10 or so plus miles that need to be approved. And House Bill 210 basically sets the state's part of the land transaction, further incumbent upon the federal aspect, which would be the Department of Interior doing a public interest finding, as well as environmental impact statement that would follow it. I've had the good fortune of traveling all throughout Southwest Alaska, being from that part of the state, and in my current job, I've landed in the Chignecks, I've landed in Perryville, I've skidded off the runway in False Pass, I've gone through high winds at St. Paul and Accutan and what have you, but I will tell you that the most harrowing 10-minute flight that one could ever take would be to fly from the world-class runway over in Cold Bay, 10,000 feet long with the cross strip of about 4,500 feet over to the smaller runway in King Cove. And with the help of a hovercraft, the last several years, the transport in between the two areas has been made much more easy, if you will. But the mayor of the Lucian's East Borough, as well as the city administrator in the audience, will talk in more detail about how expensive that is and how cumbersome it is to actually keep the hovercraft up and running and maintained and so forth. So, Madam Co-Chair, I guess I would close by saying that for the 750 or so residents of King Cove, this really is about accessing the fifth largest runway, all-weather runway in the state, and a country that's straddled by both the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea. And I think to say that it's experiences tempestuous winds would be to put it mildly, because it does blow horrifically down there on occasions. And so for the community, this is a life and safety issue. This is an opportunity to be able to access that runway basically at any time during the year and not have to be straddled with paying an exorbitant amount of money to keep a hovercraft in operation sort of year in, year out, and month in and month out. So, Madam Co-Chair, with that just sort of overview of the bill, I notice we don't have a quorum quite yet, but we do have the Department of Natural Resources online to walk you through the various components of the bill and maybe to answer any more technical questions that you might have. But to that point, if there are any questions at this time, I'd be happy to entertain them.
Thank you very much, Representative Edgman. I've been visited by the mayor and folks from the community in your district there, and I know it's a health and safety issue as well, that there's a big fear on the part of people that live in that community that should weather be what it is most days, and there be a circumstance of an exigent nature that they wouldn't have that opportunity to get out safely. And so I applaud you and the work you've done and your staff for trying to strike a compromise. It's a delicate issue, it's a delicate balance, and I'm supportive of the bill, and I appreciate you bringing it forward. Senator Wilikowski?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Edgman, just on the issue of, I guess, sort of outreach and public comment on this. I know a little bit controversial because I think it's the first time this would be done in National Wildlife Refuge. I certainly understand the health and safety concerns. Where what sort of process has this been through in terms of community involvement and outreach? And I guess, is this a compromise that's acceptable to pretty much all the parties that are out there?
Through the Madam Chair, Senator Wilikowski, the actual land transaction itself involves about 60,000 acres on one side of the ledger versus the 206 acres that would comprise the very narrow one-lane transportation corridor that would complete the road. And And there's also about 1,600 acres over off of Kodiak Island that was thrown in by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for good measure just to complete the whole effort. And you'll hear from a moment from the mayor of the Aleutians East Borough and from others as well that this compromise, if you will, if for lack of a better term, has been ongoing for, you know, literally since ANILCA was established in 1980, converting a good part of that whole National Wildlife Refuge into wilderness areas, and doing so without any consultation at all with the community members, with the fishermen, with the tribe, with the city, with anybody at the borough, and so forth. So the outreach effort the many trips back east by the folks in King Cove and in the borough, and certainly down here to Juneau, I think has been, perhaps unprecedented. So I think in terms of passing that test, they've more than done their share.
And just in terms of opposition, I mean, is this something that you think is accepted by most organizations? I know, I guess there are some environmental organizations. I mean, is this something that they've accepted as a fair compromise?
Well, the National Public Lands Bill that was passed in March of last year, to get this land transaction there took a great effort by a great many people, including our Alaska delegation, and certainly there was opposition to it. But if you bear down and look at the many sideboards that are enacted around the construction of the road itself, we're talking a single lane gravel road, steel cables on both sides, specified turnouts, and a road design that has to meet the environmental impact statement that's going to follow after, and hopefully I'm not getting ahead of myself here, but that the legislature chooses fit to approve House Bill 210. So, there have been a number of sideboards specified in the legislation itself, the federal, and you've got a state process that's involved, and then in order to complete the authorization process, you've got further sideboards in terms of public interest finding and environmental impact statement that I'm sure will be quite exhaustive.
Further questions? Okay, thank you so much, Representative Edgeman. Next, we're going to ask the mayor of King Cove to come up, and then we'll have DNR. Mayor Mack. Welcome to the Senate Resources Committee.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Just a correction. I am not the mayor of King Cove. I'm the mayor of the Aleutians East Borough. My name is Stanley Mack.
Got it. Okay. They've got it as King Cove. So.
Yes. So that he is supposed to be online, is he? Mayor of King Cove should be online, I believe.
Okay.
Good afternoon.
Got it. They're both Macks. Okay, I think we just solved the problem.
My name is Stanley Mack. I'm the mayor of the Aleutians East Borough. Thank you for this opportunity today to come before and comment on House Bill 210. I was born and raised in King Cove, and I now live in Sand Point. I also lived in Cold Bay for 10 years, and I'm a commercial fisherman out there. I respectfully request you pass this bill today out of the Senate Resource Committee. This bill is a final step in what has been a very long legislative process required for authorizing a trade of state and King Cove Corporation land to the federal government in exchange for approving a small road corridor through the Eisenbach National Wildlife Refuge. The road corridor will allow for a one-lane gravel road, as Senator or Representative Edgeman has said, so that the 800 residents of King Cove can finally have a safe and dependable access to Cold Bay Airport. Our need and desire for this surface access to Cold Bay Airport has persevered for many decades. We've been fighting for decades to get this through, and we're finally getting to a point where the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Interior Department, and all the federal agencies have agreed that this land transaction is to their best interest, and the president has signed the bill. I understand and live with daily challenges of transportation accessibility in rural Alaska. I also realize that not all of these transportation challenges can be resolved, even here in the Aleutians East Borough or elsewhere around our state. We all know that variable of weather, topography, patterns of human settlements, and money will continue to always make transportation accessibility a major challenge throughout many parts of the state of Alaska. However, King Cove's transportation access problem is different. This one can be solved. This is why we've been so persistent for so long. Now, with this major support from the state, along with the King Cove Corporation, and if you can see the land that's all in red and the one in the green and the black lines around there, that's the land that was given to the King Cove residents or the Yaluits of King Cove, and they're giving that up as part of their exchange for this 200-acre corridor through the refuge. We believe this road connection from King Cove to Colby Airport is going to happen. Furthermore, I can hardly express to you today what it means to me personally to believe that this road connection is now going to happen in my lifetime. We sincerely appreciate the support from the current legislature and administration, along with the prior two administrations, in working with to resolve the King Cove transportation access problem. This is a successful partnership between the state and local governments working together to improve the quality of life for its residents. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mayor Mack. And we appreciate your testimony. I can imagine it's been a big part of your life. And I can hear that in your voice. So thank you for being here today. Are there questions for the mayor? Okay, thank you. So now we will go to Mayor Henry Mack, who is the mayor of King Cove. Mayor Mack, are you there?
Yes, Senator McGuire.
Great. We'd love to hear your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator McGuire. Senators, my name is Henry Mack. I am the mayor of the city of King Cove. Thank you for this opportunity today to comment on House Bill 210. I was born and have lived most of my life in King Cove. I have been a commercial fisherman for the last 40 years plus. I respectfully request that to you to pass this bill today out of the Senate Resource Committee. This land exchange process is leading to the approval of a small road corridor from King Cove to the Colbert Airport has been a long time in the making. I was on the King Cove City Council back in 1976 when we adopted our first resolution identifying the need for this road to access to the Colbert Airport. The gentleman that brought forward this discussion back in 76, he personally lost a brother on a plane crash on the mountains here in King Cove, trying to find the airport in severe weather. As we understand about the weather and topographic impacts in our daily lives, this is particularly true for our accessibility to the Cove Airport, which is our primary connection to the outside world. We have winds in excess of 50 miles an hour on a regular basis. The result is that our small airport, precariously perched adjacent to volcanic mountains, is unusable for about 30 to 40% of the time for the single-engine planes making scheduled flights in and out of our community. This road will resolve our transportation access problem so that the 800 residents of King Cove can finally have a safe and dependable access to the Colby Airport. Too many lives of King Cove residents have been significantly compromised over many decades because we do not always have a predictable and available access to Colby Airport. This land exchange leading to the approval for construction, this one-lane gravel road, will have a major positive value on our quality of life by significantly decreasing the impact of weather on our ability to safely and timely access to the Colby Airport. I sincerely appreciate the support from the current legislature administration in working with us to resolve our transportation access problems. Madam Co-Chair, Senators, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mayor Mack. Questions? We appreciate your testimony. And next I'll go to Dick Milius with DNR.
Senator McGuire and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dick Milius. I'm the director of the Department of Natural Resources Division of Mining, Land, and Water. Department of Natural Resources under Alaska Statute 3850 is responsible for conducting land exchanges involving state land, and the department supports this exchange in this legislation. As Representative Edgman pointed out, this is being brought to you for two reasons. The first one is that Alaska Statute 3850.020 requires legislative approval if a land exchange is for other than equal appraised fair market values. And secondly, one of the provisions of this exchange is that certain state tidelands and submerged lands would be added to the Eisenbeck State Game Refuge. A little bit of history here. A road from King Cove to Cold Bay has been talked about for many, many years. DNR's original Bristol Bay Area Plan adopted 25 years ago identified the need for this corridor. Regional transportation plans prepared by DOT have identified the need for this road. Several years ago, the Aleutians East Borough, City of King Cove Village Corporation, Governor's Office, and DNR agreed to revive the discussions about a land exchange to enable construction of the road, and it was partly because, or largely because, the borough leaders had found that the hovercraft that had been kind of proposed as the solution to the access needs was not providing a safe, economical, long-term solution to King Cove's access needs. So as a result of that, the state, the borough, the city, and corporation met with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to develop the land exchange that is before you. The parties all recognize that the biggest hurdle for such a land exchange would be in securing approval of the Congress, the U.S. Congress, because the exchange involves federal wilderness refuge lands. The exchange legislation was introduced in 2007 into the U.S. Congress by Senator Lisa Murkowski and Representative Young. Governor Palin wrote letters in support. The state testified before the House Committee on Natural Resources in support of the bill. And the land exchange, which was originally a separate piece of legislation, was wrapped into the omnibus lands bill that was considered late in 2008 by Congress, passed in 2009, and signed into law by President Obama in March. In putting together the exchange, it was clear that due to the concerns over the unique wildlife and wilderness values of the refuge, that a simple fair market value would not adequately address wilderness values and the public or Congress's concerns for those values. So we determined from the start that the package would require legislative approval, state legislative approval. As I mentioned, there's two reasons for this, the first one being that statute requires that if an exchange is for other than an equal appraised fair market value, it requires your approval. The existing values of most of these parcels of land are wilderness and wildlife values, which are difficult to quantify in a land appraisal. And similarly, the health and safety concerns of local residents, which is the primary reason for the road, cannot be quantified by a land appraisal. Acreage-wise, the exchange is clearly skewed in favor of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The state will acquire approximately 206 acres in the road corridor and about 1,600 acres on Sitkanak Island. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will acquire 43,000 acres of state land that will be added to the National Wildlife Refuge, 2,500 acres of Native Corporation land, and another 5,430 acres of Native Corporation selections that will be relinquished. In addition, the King Cove Native Corporation has agreed that it would sell additional land to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service at fair market value should the service desire to purchase that land. In addition to the road corridor, the state will acquire a 1,600-acre parcel on Sitkanak Island. Sitkanak Island is located south of Kodiak Island, and the remainder of that island is already state or borough land used for grazing, and the 1,600-acre federal parcel is a former Coast Guard facility on that island. Regarding the two townships of state land that would be traded to the Fish and Wildlife Service, this land's primary value is wildlife habitat for fish, caribou, and brown bear. The land drains the western side of Pavlov Volcano. The lands have been offered for oil and gas leasing in previous state lease sales but have received no bids. and our geologist's assessment is generally that the likely oil and gas resources lie further north or offshore of these parcels. As I mentioned, the second provision that requires this bill to come before you is that certain state tide lands and submerged lands will be added to the state game refuge. This is, as part of the exchange agreement, we agreed that 3,000 acres of state tide lands and submerged lands in Kinzaroff Lagoon, which is at the head of Cold Bay, would be added to the state game refuge. These lands have resource values similar to Eisenbeck Lagoon, including valuable eelgrass beds, which are critical for waterfowl that migrate through or reside in the area. Again, the department and the governor support this legislation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Dick. Questions from the committee? Okay, we do have a quorum back, so if we could get a motion so that we have the CS before us.
I'll make the motion, since that was all that was gone.
Fantastic. Senator French.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'd move that we adopt CS, Senate CS for CS for House Bill number 210 / ECHO as our working document.
Excellent. Okay, so we have the bill before us, and for a bit more detail, you want to put yourself on the record?
My name is Tim Clark. I'm staff to Representative Edgman.
Great. Tim, you want to walk us through the sectional? Or however you'd like to present it.
First, in terms of the CS, with the committee's permission, I would just zero in on the one change between the House CS you've had before you and the new committee substitute here in the Senate. It's three lines on page 5, beginning line 27. And short enough to read, the construction and operation of the road described in B1 of this section is authorized after the state receives the land described in B1 of this section in accordance with PL11-11, which is, you know, the omnibus lands bill passed by Congress last year. The main reason for this minor addition is to make it clear that construction and use of the road is allowed if the land exchange is authorized, with the also an intent to cite the federal law referenced in the legislation before you. It's similar to access provisions in existing law in the state affecting other state game refuges, including the Mendenhall Wetland State Game Refuge and the Goose Bay State Game Refuge. What might not be immediately clear to the committee is that the National Wildlife Refuge, the Eisenbeck Refuge, is actually superimposed, you might say, over a state game refuge, so that while the corridor becomes state land, it also becomes arguably state game refuge land. And this being similar to other provisions for access in state game refuges, we just thought it would be prudent to add it to the bill.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, so give us a brief overview, if you want. We sort of know what the bill does, but whatever you feel you want to supplement in terms of the detail on the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The bill is rather complex for a 7-page bill. Mainly this is because there are three mechanisms in the federal legislation that this bill answers that can render the exchange null and void. One is a finding of the Secretary of the Interior that the exchange is not in the public interest, which we hope obviously will not be the case. The second is actually a voluntary rendering of null and void by the state or the native corporation. That voluntary action would have to be made before construction of the road commenced, and that obviously would be because they wouldn't want the land to be altered in any significant way before it being returned. The third rendering of null and void would happen if construction of the road or permitting of the road was not accomplished within 7 years of the Federal Act's passage, which is actually 7 years, the clock beginning last year in March when the President signed that legislation. So essentially, this challenging structure that exists in the bill is there so that if for any of these reasons the exchange is voided, there is no need to revisit statute to ensure that all involved lands are returned to their original status.
Okay.
So, of course, we hope very fervently that all of this progresses, ending in the road. However, if that's not the case, the legislature has saved the trouble of having to convene to dismantle, you know, any of these transactions. If the committee desires, I could walk you through these sections.
No, thank you. Okay, we appreciate it. We're going to go ahead and take one more thank you, one more person's testimony. We're going to set the bill aside and bring it back up tomorrow. So if members want to look over it tonight and be sure every I is dotted and T is crossed, but a lot of hard work has gone into this, and we
this
know.
This is the last committee, Madam Chair?
No, goes to finance.
Thank you.
We're all good bills.
Almost bills.
Go to live and to fight another day. Okay, so we have Gary Hennig. Questions only, Gary?
Yeah, questions.
Okay, so you're okay. All right, anyone else here in the audience wishing to testify on the committee substitute for House Bill 210? Anybody online I've overlooked? Okay, hearing and seeing none, we'll close testimony, set the bill aside, bring it back up tomorrow. And thank you very much, Representative Edgman. Okay, next we have House Bill, HJR 40. And we're going to take a brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record in Senate Resources, and we have HJR 40 before us, a resolution pertaining to the beluga whale population in Cook Inlet. We have Representative Millett to tell us about it.
Thank you, McGuire, and members of the Senate Resources Committee. Thank you for taking up this resolution today. The resolution that you're hearing, the joint resolution that you're hearing, is opposing the proposed designation by the National Marine Fisheries of 3,000 square miles of Cook Inlet, mid-inlet all the way to the inlet's western shores of Kachemak Bay. The critical habitat designation is part of the ESA process. In October of 2008, the belugas were designated as endangered species. And under the endangered species habitat, you're required to look at a listing for critical habitat. So what this resolution is saying is when the National Marine Fisheries came in and took into account where the beluga's habitat was, they designated the whole 3,000 square foot from Upper Cook Inlet, like I said, all the way down to Homer. And we are, my resolution opposes that measure of habitat. I believe it is excessive, and I think that one of the things that the ESA allows for under the critical habitat listing is to take in economic consequences. Mm. The National Marine Fisheries weighed in. They said that the economic impact would be $600,000, and I believe that is grossly underestimated for what this designation would do. This critical habitat would encompass everything from the Port of Anchorage to fishing grounds outside of Homer and Kenai to oil and gas exploration and any type of construction or resource development that would take place across the inlet, which would jeopardize not only the Mount Spur, but the Chacachamas, the Sitna, and any other coal gasification projects that we're looking at. So those are things that I don't think were taken into consideration when we looked at, when the National Marine Fisheries looked at what a vast array of land they were encompassing under critical habitat. One of the interesting things that I learned as I started researching what the critical habitat would do, they listed the west side of Cook Inlet as critical habitat. There has been one sighting of a beluga whale in the last 10 years on the west side of the Cook Inlet. The other things that I've been researching and have found out that National Marine Fisheries only counts the beluga whales once a year. They do an aerial flight. The one group of beluga whales that aren't accounted for is the juvenile belugas, because juvenile belugas are the exact same color as the mud in the Cook Inlet. They basically look like waves in the ocean, and they aren't accounted for in the count. So these things that this designation not only would be an economic devastating effect on Anchorage, but on the whole state of Alaska. 85% of our products come in to the Port of Anchorage that are distributed throughout the state of Alaska, and it would severely limit the things that we could do as far as exploration and Cook Inlet for oil and gas development. So with that, the resolution would be sent down to Congress. All three of our members have opposed this designation and have been vocal about what the economic impacts of this designation would do. I will tell you that when I was down in D.C., I took the House-passed version of the resolution and entered it into the National Marine Fisheries public comment period. So the resolution is there, not complete because it wasn't passed by the Senate, but it was passed by the 40 members of the House. So with that, I would just ask for your support in passing this and sending a message that we think that the proposed designation area is much too large, and the belugas themselves have been coming back at a rate of 4% increase. I can give you a little historical background on the belugas. Back in the 90s, there was a subsistence hunt that took place. It wasn't managed at the time. Folks were coming in and subsisting on beluga whales, not recognizing that there was a delicate balance between the subsistence harvest and the population of the belugas. They have since, in 1998, gone through and done a harvest management plan. And since that time, the belugas have shown an increase, and even the National Marine Fisheries said that the reason for the decline was nothing more than just an over-harvest of the species. So with that, I will entertain any questions, and thank you for hearing the resolution today.
Thank you, Representative Millett. Questions from the committee regarding the resolution? Senator French.
I'll ask a couple. I haven't studied this issue very carefully, but I'm aware that it's been in the news, and so I'm glad you're bringing it to our attention. I just wonder, first of all, what would be a more reasonable designation? If it shouldn't be all 3,000 square miles of Upper Cook Inlet, what would be a more reasonable designation? Or do you know if anyone's sort of proposed something that you think is a more reasonable designation? Let me put it that way.
To the Chair, Senator French, there isn't an opportunity to go in and give your recommendations on what the designation is. It's a tool that the National Marine Fisheries has, not something that we can publicly comment on or that we can weigh in or sway a decision done by a biologist. And since I'm not a biologist, although I've observed the belugas all my life living in South Central, I don't believe that the west side of Cook Inlet is a place that we should be designating. And I think there's a more reasonable designation that could be done.
So at the very least, you'd cut out the west side of the inlet, which is a place where you say you don't see belugas. That seems reasonable to me.
It does, through the Chair, Senator French. I mean, personally, I believe that the belugas are coming back because the subsistence hunts are done, and it's just going to take the species a little while to rebound. So if I had my personal preference, there'd be no designation, obviously, because I think that the increase in the population is moving forward in the manner in which the National Marine Fisheries themselves said that it would take up to 10 to 15 years to have that population increase. So I think what we're doing currently by, one, having a harvest management plan in place with two belugas a year, I think that's a good measure, and I think that giving that the opportunity to have the belugas rebound on their own is would be my personal preference.
If I may, Madam Chair, I saw a good presentation that Jason Bruni made to the RDC a couple of years ago, sort of outlining his view of this and the subsistence harvest and the over-harvesting and so forth. It was a good and persuasive presentation. I wonder, and I just can't remember, and do you maybe remember what the beluga population was in the 80s before that subsistence harvest took place?
I do. I believe it started out at 1,300, and then in 1994 it was 653, 347 in 1998, and that's when the subsistence harvest took place. And I believe we're up to 380. We're up to 321 belugas in 2009, and there hasn't been a 2010 count yet. So I can give you some numbers. So you can go 94, there was 653. 2004, there was 366. 2005, 278. And 2009, they rebounded to 321. So it's about a 4% increase throughout the years since the subsistence management plan has been in place.
And it sounded like part of the problem was that the National Marine Fisheries is only doing one count a year. Is that right?
Correct.
Should we be appropriating more money to count beluga whales?
Through the chair, Senator French, if you can convince the National Marine Fisheries to increase their count and to count juvenile beluga whales, I think that would be a very good thing to do, although I don't think I have much influence on federal funding. But
I couldn't resist. I'm sorry.
Senator Wagner.
Yeah, this kind of catch-as-catch-can because I fished that inlet for over 30 years, and better part of 40 years. And some years you'll see quite a few belugas, some years you won't. So I even question how accurate their counts are that they say are their official counts, because there's nothing harder to count than a beluga whale in Upper Cook Inlet. Because the only time you see them is when they porpoise and come to the top. The only place you can count them is in Lower Cook Inlet. And really, the belugas disappear when the food source disappears. So the only time they're really in Cook Inlet is when there's either the smelter running, the hooligan, the herring, or the salmon. And any other time, they totally disappear from Cook Inlet. You never see a beluga around there. So I think the real fallacy is, and I know these people are supposedly, quote unquote, qualified scientists, but for them to say that this is a subspecies of beluga whales is just something I don't like to get into discussing, because I don't know where they come up with that. They say it's a genetic thing, but that's really hard to believe, because there's beluga whales all over the world. So I don't really believe. I believe the number of belugas probably is mathematically you could study the amount of salmon and the amount of hooligan and the amount of herring that are coming back into Upper Cook Inlet and see how much of the food source, how much that will support and how much they can harvest, and you can get a pretty good idea of how many belugas were there, because if there's not enough food source for the belugas, they aren't going to come there. That's the bottom line of this whole thing, and nobody wants to talk about that.
Great, yeah.
So thanks for the resolution.
We appreciate the resolution, and it's a part of a broader subject that we've talked about, and I know you have in your body regarding the looking at the Endangered Species Act and how it's being used in some cases and what that impact might be on development in Alaska. And I know the Attorney General has a unit that he's formed, and I know Fish and Game has a unit they've formed. And our hope is that at a minimum that as they make these designations that they'll lean on the state in which they're making the designation for data. And that's one of the things I know Fish and Game is working on to at least, again, for the data to know what the counts might be and those kinds of things. So thank you for bringing it forward. Thanks for your leadership. Jason Bruni, you're on the phone there for questions. Is there anything you wanted to add?
Thank you, Chairman McGuire, Chairman Milikowski, and members of the committee. I am happy to answer questions. I have a page worth of testimony I'd be happy to give, but in the trying to save time, I'll just open myself up to questions and thank both Senator Wagner and Senator French for their statements that they've made and concur completely with them, and thank Representative Millett as well for her leadership with this resolution.
Thank you very much, Jason, and we will take your comments, the written comments, if you'd like, and put them as a part of the record. And appreciate your leadership, and it sounds like you give a good presentation on it, so I look forward to seeing that sometime. Okay, anybody else here in the audience wishing to testify in HJR 40 that I've overlooked? Anybody else online? Okay, hearing and seeing none, public testimony then is closed on HJR 40. We'll set it aside and bring it back up again tomorrow, and appreciate you guys being here.
Thank you, Senator McGuire.
Okay, next we are going to HJR 26. Representative Fairclough. Welcome. Put yourself on the record and tell us about it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Crystal Keenum, and staff to Representative Fairclough. She does send her apologies for not being able to be here today. What we have before us, pardon me, Madam Chair. What we have before us is HJR 26, which urges Congress to adequately fund land surveys here in Alaska. At statehood, Alaska was granted a land entitlement from the federal government of approximately 103 million acres. And Alaska Natives, through the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, were granted a land entitlement from the federal government of already 45 million acres. Currently, Congress is not sufficiently budgeting the funds to the United States Bureau of Land Management, which is preventing the timely completion of land surveys for lands that were promised to the natives and the state of Alaska. This was promised to have been done by our 50th statehood anniversary, and as we know, that has come and gone. And although significant steps have been made, it does still remain unfinished. And, Madam Chair, that's the general basis of this resolution, and we're just urging Congress to adequately fund.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Crystal. We appreciate your testimony. There is an amendment here in our packets. Is this something that the representative is supporting?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. The amendment that you do have, since this was introduced last year, and they're continuing making steps to fund the land surveys, these are updated numbers that we did receive from the Department of Natural Resources, and that would then update them to reflect accurately for this year.
Okay, thank you. I'll go ahead and move amendment number one, then, that's in our packets, updating the numbers, deleting December 31st, 2008, and the figure of $66 million, inserting January 30th, 2010, inserting $57 million, and then the commensurate numbers. Do you have that? Everybody have the amendment?
Backslash R2?
Yep.
Yes.
Is there an objection to amendment number one? Okay, hearing and seeing none, we do have amendment number one carries, so we do have House Joint Resolution number 26 before us, amended. Are there questions for the bill sponsors, Representative Senator Wilikowski?
A really basic question. What's the importance of getting a patent, a land patent?
The importance of getting a land patent, I can follow up more accurately with that for you and have an official response. But it makes things a little bit easier. Is the quick and simple answer.
Senator Wilikowski?
If you have something maybe back in your office you could get me, I'd just be curious to
absolutely
find out the importance of that.
Okay, anybody else here in the audience wishing to testify in HJR 26? Anybody online I've overlooked? Okay, hearing and seeing none, then public testimony is closed on House Joint Resolution 26 as amended. We'll set that bill aside and bring it back up, and appreciate you being here. Okay, last on the list, HCR number 10, Representative Hawker. Tell us about...
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for the privilege of being one more time before the Senate Resources Committee.
We like you. We think the feeling's mutual.
I hope you keep that attitude in the next couple of days, ma'am.
We're liking it.
The next couple of weeks.
couple of weeks.
Week and a half.
Yeah. Nine days.
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, Representative Mike Hawker, District 32, South Central Alaska. I'm here to ask your support for today is work that began last session, and we're hoping to complete it this session. This is a resolution, and it's a, I would put it in the category, if it's another resolution, and remember last session, last year, we addressed a number of issues that involved states' rights and the continuing fight for Alaska's land and sovereign entitlement to the rights to our own resources, whatever they might be. The issue behind concurrent resolution number 10, Kay, was brought to me originally by a constituent of mine who will be online, I believe, to testify and really provide the personal experience points. But it gets to the issue of the state's ownership of our submerged lands and navigable waters. I think, you know, if it's all right with the committee, we beg the question. That is something that is, in fact, guaranteed by the laws of the state's constitution and subsequent interpretations, you know, unless there is some very specific federal override. Particular issues up in sort of north central, the upper areas of the Yukon and the like, and again, my constituent can speak to them directly, is that back in 1996, the National Park Service started adopting regulations which improperly extend its own claims of management and enforcement authorities over state-owned navigable waters within the units of the National Park System. The evidentiary material that I'd offer that specifically document this concern is a letter that is in your packet, should be in your packet, from the State of Alaska, the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas, and it's a letter that was dated February 13th, 2009. And it, you know, respecting the state commission that we specifically reauthorized on the issues of how to preserve and protect our pursuit of our state land rights, this commission had identified and analyzed this problem and came up with a specific request, and they requested the governor to file a lawsuit challenging these regulations. We also noted that early on the letter included Senators Bundy and Senator Terrio as potential sponsors of legislation, and clearly we've lost one of them and almost lost the other to the legislative process, so ended up with this resolution in my office here. We're also on these issues of the National Park Service overriding its authority, issuing citations and attempting to inappropriately impose its own regulatory authority over state land and resources. The Citizens Advisory Commission acknowledges as that we're just basically done with attempts at administrative remedies, and they wanted a go-to-court legal remedy. However, we toned that language down a bit in the resolution and are getting to, you know, the operative points is that we're asking the administration to take all available actions to stop this action. Really to, I think it's a bit imprudent to say, go file a lawsuit, but to really have us asking the administration through the course of the resolution to say, this remains another very important concern of Alaska citizens. It's an encroachment upon our state rights as as the sovereign state of Alaska. And again, we're asking, just putting more emphasis on asking the governor to continue to stand up for Alaska's state rights as opposed to the continued intrusion from our good friends at the federal government. And the second point of the resolution is saying, you know, please give us resources to whatever your agencies need to pursue this. So again, Madam Chair, I would say a resolution of the sort we have seen before, and that's again asking our executive to assert our state rights. But in this case, it's a new issue, a separate issue than we've addressed before, and that's the navigability issue on submerged lands.
Got it. Thank you very much, Representative Hawker. Questions for the bill sponsor? This time? Okay, seeing none, we appreciate it. We've got just a few folks for questions from DNR, if there are questions from DNR staff. Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if someone can tell me if there is any interplay between this resolution and the Katie John case.
So we have Dick Miles and Tina Cunning. Can either of you answer that question, please?
This is Dick Miles, Director of DNR Division of Mining, Land, and Water. It's probably, let's see, I'm not with the Department of Law, so I guess I'll just say generally not. I mean, there is some linkages because they're both dealing with navigable waters, but Katie John deals with Federal Reserve water rights, and this deals with a Park Service regulation. So there's really not any significant interplay in the specific regulation. I'm sure the lawyers would tell you there's some connections there, but challenging this regulation would have no real impact on Katie John, I believe.
Further questions, Senator French?
I'm wondering if there's anybody else online who might have anyone wants to add any detail to that.
Tina, did you?
This is Tina Cunning with the Commissioner's Office, the Department of Fish and Game. As Dick said, there's no direct connection. The Katie John 2 case is a Federal Reserve water rights case, has to do with only locating where the federal subsistence priority applies in state waters. The National Park Service water regs issue is an ANILCA case related to where federal regulations that are promulgated for the management of federal lands can apply off of federal lands onto state waters.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions for the DNR staff? Thank you for being online. Anybody else here in the audience wishing to offer testimony on the CS for HCR number 10? Anybody online? Okay, then hearing and seeing none, we'll close public testimony and set the bill aside to bring back up. Thank you, Representative Hawker, and we're adjourned.
Madam Chairman?
Oh.
I'm sorry, we have one at the Anchorage LIO.
I'll come back in order. If you could just state your name.
Good afternoon. My name is John Sturgeon.
Hi, John. I'll go ahead and open public testimony back up again. You wanted to offer testimony on HCR 10?
I'll be very brief, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Again, my name is John Sturgeon. I'm here representing myself. The state of Alaska owns a submerged lands designated as navigable. This includes rivers such as the Yukon. Several years ago, while I was hunting on a Yukon, I was stopped by the National Park Service police and told that I could not drive my 5-foot-wide, 10-foot-long hovercraft down the Yukon River. The National Park Service said they had a legal jurisdiction above that of the state of Alaska, even though they admitted I was, in fact, on state land. Later, after I returned back to Anchorage, I did some research and learned that the state constitution, the statutes, and the regulations all very clearly say the state of Alaska has management authority on its navigable waters. In addition, I learned that Section 103C of ANILCA says that on ANILCA-designated units, federal conservation unit regulations promulgated by the federal government do not apply to state and private land. It's one of those ANILCA promises that the state of Alaska was made, which once again was ignored. In conclusion, it is of little use for the state of Alaska to own its submerged lands on navigable waterways if the National Park Service is going to override its management. I again urge your support of House Joint Resolution Number 10. And if you'd like to answer any questions, I'd be sure glad to do that. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, John. My apologies. You weren't on our list, and thank you for chiming in. Appreciate hearing your testimony. Any questions for Mr. Sturgeon? Okay. Hearing and seeing none, then we will close public testimony, and we will set the House concurrent resolution to the side. Thank you, Representative Hawker, and all those that testified, and we will go ahead and adjourn the Senate Resources Committee.